Welcome to Y2K, the podcast where your host, Amanda Ladino, escapes her existence and subsequent existential crisis into the peaceful portal of films from before the year 2000. This week, we're discussing My Cousin Vinny from 1992, a legal comedy that inspires me not to be a lawyer, but to find an alternate universe where I'm a tough son of a bitch from New York. While having a fun road trip to the South, said no one from a marginalized community ever, New Yorkers Bill and Stan go to buy some tuna and beans for the road that I guess are just going to eat cold from the can at the local sack of suds. When driving away, Bill realizes that he forgot to pay for the can of tuna that he put in his pocket because he didn't have any room left in his arms. I mean, it's a little tiny silver sliver, but okay. And Stan laughs it off as a likely story until a cop pulls him over. Bill, thinking he's being convicted for stealing tuna, confesses to the crime, wanting to get the whole thing over with. But Sheriff Farley later reveals that Bill is being charged with the murder of the sack of suds clerk, Jimmy Willis, and Stan is being charged as an accessory to murder. And after the sheriff refuses Bill's request to... Whoa, wait a minute! Bill calls his mom for him and Stan, since Stan's parents are conveniently traveling in Chile. Bill pleads not guilty and for a good attorney. Unfortunately, diamonds aren't Bill's best friend. Stan is. And the only other accessory they're getting other than Stan is a pair of cufflinks. Bill's mom can't afford a good attorney, but she can afford his cousin Vinny. Unfortunately, it's revealed that while Vinny and his fiancée Mona Lisa Vito know how to make an entrance, they don't know how to blend on or off the court. But six times a charm. And now that Vinny's passed the bar and got 6 weeks of personal injury non-trial practice under his big buckle leather belt, he's ready to go in with no courtroom experience. Soul-crushingly, to the dismay of Vinny and goths all over the world, black leather does not go with everything. And Vinny is informed by the strict judge that his leather forward attire is not suitable for the courtroom. And apparently swearing isn't either, and neither is lying about courtroom experience. And you know what? Let's just keep this quick. Here's a giant book listing everything that's not acceptable. I certainly hope none of these previous listed infringements land Vinny in contempt of court multiple times. But who am I kidding? No Gambini, that's for certain. Let's forget that, and the legal bible, and just take a nice 2-hour rest. Vinny and Lisa are startled awake by a steam whistle and decide to go to a diner and make the difficult decision to select breakfast, and after thorough investigation, Vinny has his first grit. Cholesterol-y full, Vinny heads on over to court for Bill and Stan's arraignment, and after being reprimanded by the judge for his casual attire and failing to stand up to address the court, Vinny's over it. The judge repeatedly asks how his clients plead, and Vinny decides to just get everything cleared up and over with, and decides to argue their innocence instead of saying guilty or not guilty. The judge holds Vinny in contempt of court, and he's arrested, and Lisa has to pay $200 to bail him out. After waiting for Vinny with the protesters against the upcoming execution of a prisoner named Norton that they're gonna nuke this week, Lisa is worried that Bill and Stan could be sentenced to death. Bill and Stan, also worried that they'll be sentenced to death, have doubts about Vinny's ability to win this case. But Bill won't fire his cousin, and convinces Stan that he shouldn't either because Vinny is the best magician heckler around. After sticking to his fashion instincts and not wearing a suit in court again, Vinny is found in contempt of court again, and is bailed out. But he's determined to get a good night's sleep and checks into a new hotel. And there's no train whistle. There's just hogs getting slaughtered. And unfortunately, Vinny's also on the chopping block. Stan decides to hire the state attorney, and Bill's gonna go as well, until Vinny wins him over with a card trick. Things are looking up after the prosecutor invites Vinny to go hunting. This gives Vinny plenty of time to finesse Trotter for his files. And after slyly asking him straight out to look at his files, Trotter makes Vinny a copy of them for him to review. Vinny triumphantly returns to Lisa, who informs him that according to the book on Alabama court procedure the judge gave him, Trotter has to give Vinny his files. Whatever. He's got the files and the keys to the district attorney's cabin. Now he'll finally get some sleep. Nope. Lisa's biological clock isn't the only thing making noise. The local nature is rowdy. And Vinny can't sleep in the cabin. He's gotta sleep in the car. With a nice rainstorm, he'll fall asleep for sure. Lisa and Vinny wake up, and both of them in the car are bent out of shape. The car is stuck in Alabama's famous mud, and it ruins Vinny's suit. With only an hour until the trial begins, and a store-wide flu epidemic, Lisa has no choice but to get Vinny a second-hand red velvet suit. The judge is not having it when Vinny arrives late and doesn't sing even one crooner song and holds him in contempt of court. Vinny's tired, he's over it, and he's done beating around the bush. Alright, everything Trotter said is, quote, bullshit. If only Stan's attorney could speak as eloquently. Unfortunately, he has a stutter, which people were not as empathetic towards in 1992. The first witness is called and claims he saw Bill and Stan enter the sack of suds from his home. He proceeded to cook grits from scratch and 5 minutes later sat down to eat breakfast as Bill and Stan allegedly fled the sack of suds. After previous research, Vinny catches that the witness couldn't have seen Bill and Stan enter and leave within 5 minutes because unless a scientific miracle happened, grits take 20 minutes to make from scratch. Stan flip-flops back to Vinny and rehires him. Vinny, jubilant on his first win, decides to stay in prison and get a good night's sleep. The next day, Vinny continues on his winning streak and performs a witness's annual vision test and determines that she could not have clearly seen them from the distance that she claimed. And the other witness is ruled out after Vinny tears apart his gardening and window cleaning abilities. But then, plot twist, not really everyone saw it coming, an expert witness testifies that the tire marks left in the sack of suds parking lot match the tires on Bill's mint green 1964 Buick Skylark. But almost every car has these tires. How can Vinny disprove that? During a lunch break, Lisa shows Vinny all the photos she took on the trip, and Vinny dismisses them as garbage photos that can't win a case or even a spot in the album. Lisa storms out. Back in court, Vinny checks out the photos again, probably to see what he actually looks like in the shower, and he realizes something unrelated to the shower centerfold. Vinny needs Lisa to go on the stand as an expert in General Automotives. Trotter tests Mona Lisa's expertise with a trick question, and she chews him and the scenery up like a 20-minute soaked grit. Vinny shows her one of her pictures of the tire tracks at the sack of suds, and she examines it, and she's positive that she sees the same thing that Vinny just discovered, and declares, "The defense is wrong! The tire tracks are in a solid line, equally far apart as they go over a median. The car that made these marks is a 1963 Pontiac Tempest. The only car resembling a Buick Skylark with positive traction, a limited slip differential, and independent rear suspension. All of which are necessary to make those marks and are available in the same metallic mint green paint since both cars were made by GM. Vinny calls the other expert back to the stand and he confirms Mona Lisa's statement. Sheriff Farley runs a search for stolen or abandoned 1963 Tempests and finds a report of two men driving a 1963 Pontiac Tempest who were recently arrested in Georgia with the same type of gun that killed Jimmy Willis. The case is dismissed! Vinny and Mona Lisa peel out and discuss their next legal case, the case for their marriage. We are now entering the facts machine portion of the podcast where we discuss facts about the movie. My Cousin Vinny was released on March 13, 1992. The film had a budget of $11 million. The shoestring budget was because 20th Century Fox decided to invest in Alien 3 and White Men Can't Jump. When the movie was released, the number one slot had been filled by Wayne's World for about a month, and critics weren't originally wowed with the movie, despite the movie bringing in $53 million at the box office. Although it was never a hit in the South, the creator believes this was because of the line, "The Klan's here, they're inbred, they sleep with their sisters," said by Stan in the trailer. But he said that it played forever in New York, it was like E.T. And its mark was everlasting in rentals, DVD and VHS sales, and TV airings. Tomei won an Oscar for Best Supporting Actress. There's lore that the presenter of the award, Jack Palance, was not at full capacity when he read it and mistakenly said Tomei's name when the actual winner was Vanessa Redgrave, which is obviously not true, further proven by the La La Land debacle. Casting the part of Lisa was the toughest part to cast. The director, Jonathan Lynn, said the studio offered the role to any Italian-American with a big name, but they all passed. Then one day, John Landis, who directed the 1991 Sylvester Stallone movie Oscar, called Lynn and asked him if he wanted to look at the set before it was broken down after they finished filming. Lynn saw Tomei act in the movie and saw that she had good timing and told Fox that he knew who he wanted to cast as Mona Lisa. Fox asked for screen tests for his top three choices. Lynn filmed the three tests and brought them to Pesci, who at the time was filming Goodfellas, and Pesci agreed that Marissa Tomei was the best. Fox chose someone else from the tests, and after arguing with the studio for about a half an hour, Lynn said Pesci thought it should be Tomei, and they agreed to cast her. When casting Vinny, Fox actually suggested Pesci, but he wasn't the only candidate for the role. Andrew Dice Clay was one of the first people that they went to. The creator imagined Vinny as a heavyweight boxer that looked like a big thug or mob muscle. He saw him as 6'4 and 220 pounds. So obviously Joe Pesci got the part. Danny Vito met with Lawner in the early stages, but decided not to take the part because he felt that Lawner's heart wasn't in it. Other actors up for the role were Peter Falk, Robert De Niro, and Jim Belushi. Supposedly, Belushi was the one that came the closest, but he passed on it because he was attached to an early version of A League of Their Own in the role that went to Tom Hanks. I find this a little strange because I see Belushi the least as Vinny from that lineup. I think Falk and De Niro are good choices, but if you imagine them in the courtroom, specifically in the scene where Joe Pesci disproves a witness who says it took him 5 minutes to make his grit, when Pesci says to the witness, "I'm sorry, I was all the way over there, I couldn't hear you. Did you say you're a fast cook, that's it? Are we to believe that boiling water soaks into a grit faster in your kitchen than on any place on the face of the earth? Or perhaps the law of physics ceased to exist on your stove?" And I think, I know that sounded nothing like Pesci, but imagine. I think Falk, even though, as shown in Cassavetes' films, to be able to dial it up to 100 and go from really, really early quiet where you're like, please just say something, and then to bombastically scary, I think viewers still would corner him into asking the question like Columbo, where it kind of seems like he's actually legitimately asking a question, but the viewer knows that he's on to the witness. Like, he would be like, "I'm sorry, dear. I was all the way over there. I couldn't hear. Could you say that one more time? Just one more question." And I think De Niro, who can bring the comedy, as seen in Midnight Run, would have gone too far into, like, "I'm tired of this fucking bullshit. Are you fucking kidding me?" kind of mad. But Pesci brings the kind of energetic, amused, ironic, what are you fucking stupid kind of anger. They were originally hesitant to cast Pesci because he was originally known as a dramatic actor. But after Home Alone and Lethal Weapon 2, they were sure of his comedic chops, and he was just finishing up Goodfellas and was free to work on the movie. Everything lined up. The only concern that Pesci had was the 22-year age gap between him and Tomei. But because of his work on Goodfellas, which Scorsese was wary of casting him in because he pictured a younger actor for the role Pesci plays, Pesci told Scorsese that he could make it work, and he slapped on a bunch of makeup and used those, like, string things that pull back your face at the eyebrows, and then he placed that under a wig. So Pesci decided to do the same thing in My Cousin Vinny. And if you think that's commitment, Pesci also learned how to do the card trick and convinced Lynn that instead of a conventional fight with a guy that owes him $200, he should just walk across the street and leap at him. Ben Stiller was up for the role of Bill, and Will Smith was up for the role of Stan. Ultimately, it was decided that casting a Jewish man and a black man being arrested in the Deep South would change the narrative from a comedy to a drama. So the parts eventually went to Ralph Macchio and Mitchell Whitfield. Macchio actually often gets asked to sign cans of tuna, and actually kept the can of tuna from set. Austin Pendleton, who I know as Simon Larrabee from What's Up Doc with Barbara Streisand, was a friend of Lynn's and a real-life stutterer. He had stuttered since childhood, and it never went away completely. He only agreed to do the role after having a nice dinner with Lynn, but went on to unfortunately regret it. Pendleton said it brought back his worst teenage years, and it almost ended his career because casting agents and directors said he'd never be as good again, and other than The Mirror Has Two Faces, again with Barbara Streisand, Pendleton was never in a major movie again. Pendleton also received tons of angry letters from stutterers, which is just heartbreaking. Fred Gwynn, who was known for playing Herman Munster, was cast as a judge, and this was his final film. Bruce McGill, who was cast as the sheriff, was friends with Pesci, and they were actually golfing buddies at the time. The movie My Cousin Vinny was named the third greatest legal movie of all time by the American Bar Association. Number one is To Kill a Mockingbird, and number two is 12 Angry Men. The film's creator is Dale Lawner, who had already written Dirty Rotten Scoundrels and Ruthless People. That's how he knew Danny DeVito to suggest the role to him. When Lawner was in college, a friend of his in law school told him about a guy who took the bar 13 times before passing. And Lawner thought, wouldn't it be funny if you're traveling through the Deep South and you're arrested for a murder you didn't commit, and the only lawyer that can help you took 13 times to pass the bar, but he was really good at arguing? In the original script, Lawner actually explains that Vinny has dyslexia, which is why it took him 6 times to pass the bar, and why it's such a big deal that he can't read that big book of court procedure. Lawner based Vinny and Mona Lisa's dynamic after two of his college friends that were dating and said that fighting was like a fun performance art thing for them. Because Lawner didn't know anything about the South, he traveled there for inspiration. He flew to New Orleans, drove up to Mississippi, went to Jackson, and then went east into Alabama. And I don't know anything about geography, so I'm assuming he just, you know, he went around everywhere. He stopped in Butler, Alabama, and talked with an assistant district attorney, which became the model for Jim Trotter. During this trip, Lawner's car supposedly got stuck in the mud in Mississippi, and after it was towed out, it kept making a weird noise, and he took it to a tire place, and the guy working there said the lines about the mud being in his tire, and said the line, "We're famous for our mud." When Lawner returned, he met with attorney Doug Knoll to learn about the law. At one point, he asked Knoll what class teaches you criminal court procedure, and Knoll informed him that no class does. You either go to court to observe, or you learn from the firm that hires you. Lawner realized that if Vinny had only gone to court once to fight a ticket, and then went to a court to defend a case, he'd be screwed. Lonner didn't want the movie to be North versus South. He wanted it to be blue collar versus the system, which is why the district attorney has a suffix in his last name. You know, he's the third. And this is just to establish that he's a part of the system, old family, old money. And the suit debacle is meant to further show this divide. The judge, who is a part of the system, wants Vinny to wear a suit to show respect. Vinny and Lisa, who are former mechanics and a current hairdresser in Lisa's case, who are now entering this world of the system, don't really understand why the judge would see Vinny not wearing a suit as an insult. The director of the film, Jonathan Lynn, did go to law school and made sure almost everything was legally accurate in the script. Lynn also went to watch a murder trial for 3 days in Georgia and took a lot of the language for the script, such as the line about the English ancestors and the reading of the word heinous crime. While in Georgia, Lynn heard on the radio about a boy that they had electrocute 3 times and his head caught on fire, and Lynn decided to put it in the script. When prepping the script with Pesci at the Mayflower Hotel in New York, Pesci said to Lynn, "The two Utes." And Lynn said, "The two what?" And he said, "Utes." "What? The two youths." And then Lynn put it in the script. And that's where we get the Utes scene with the judge. You know, Lynn was also hired to do the rewrites. They didn't hire Lonner to do the rewrites. And Lynn had to make a lot of cuts because the original script would have been 3 hours long. The studio actually wanted to cut down even more of the movie, but the creator and the director believed that if they cut any more, they'd cut the setup to the big break in the case and it'd affect the payoff. So they decided to screen it, and the feedback was so good that the studio told them to keep it as it is. While on the topic of the script is so trim, almost everything is needed to build up to the ending like the creators and directors argued for. The one exception being the scene where Stan meets Vinny for the first time and thinks Vinny is a prisoner that's going to make Stan his sex slave. The scene was actually almost cut because it wasn't accurate that they'd meet in their cell. They would have met in the interview room, which we see in the scene after this. The major change in the original script is that in the original script, they didn't link the murder to anyone else explicitly. Bill and Stan were just proven innocent. They really didn't want there to be a quote-unquote bad guy to put a face to. You know, the murderer isn't the bad guy of the movie. The sheriff isn't a bad guy. He's a cop who wants to catch whoever committed the crime, which is why he helps secure the research to exonerate Bill and Stan. The bad guy is the system that convicts and kills people who are innocent. But ultimately, they decided to have an unnamed, unseen character who was caught as a murderer to make it super official for audiences that Bill and Stan did not commit the crime. The next major change was, in the original script, Vinny figures out the clue in the photo when they were at lunch looking at the photos. But to build tension and payoff, they rewrote it to have Vinny figure out the clue at the court. A potential rewrite that didn't happen was the studio wanted Vinny to have Lisa's big speech about the Pontiac Tempest. But the creator and director argued that Vinny put Lisa on the stand because he knows that she's going to notice and because they just had the fight at lunch. It's a romantic gesture to her when she realizes that she's on the stand to help Vinny. And the entire movie builds up to that moment on the stand when they're working out their relationship and winning the case. In the first scene that we see with Lisa, she's taking a photo of Vinny, linking their relationship and what's going to win the case. And when they go to the first motel and Lisa asks Vinny what she can do to help, this starts a running theme showing that this is how Lisa shows love, by helping Vinny. And in the background, the song playing is Stand By Your Man. And then we go on to the faucet scene. And in this scene, you really start to see that it's not that they like each other despite fighting constantly. They like fighting with each other, and they bond over this fighting and over mechanics like the faucet, which both come back in that final court scene. The movie has two themes, the court case and the relationship. And in the final court case scene, this is when the two themes finally intersect and everything resolves in one fell swoop. The film was shot in Georgia because Georgia, most notably Atlanta, had more studio resources than Alabama. The town location was three towns in Georgia, all an hour away from each other. And during location hunting, they got the idea for signs like Dirt for Sale. And that is so realistic because I went to Vermont once and almost every place had like five gardens and a sign that said like, we have maple syrup or we have apples. They're really about selling their brand. Everything but the courtroom was shot on location. They shot in a real prison in Gainesville, Georgia. They had guards with them at all times, and the guards in the movie were the actual prison guards. There was a number of security issues, and it took them 30 to 45 minutes to get from any outside shot to an inside shot. The lumber mill is a real lumber mill, and the director made sure to catch multiple shots of log trucks to indicate lumber as the main industry of the town. Extras were mostly locals that wanted to be in the movie. The extra that downs the chicken leg and cleans it off in one go, that came up when they were just fooling around on set, and the extra showed him that he could do that, so they just put it in the scene. They used a real screech owl. They artificially produce a screech in audio looping after. To get the owl to open its beak to look like it was screeching, they just like hung a little bit of beef above it. The owl was technically trained to not be frightened by gunshots, so when Pesci fires the gun, it wouldn't fly away. But the head movement when the owl looks at Pesci was a genuine first take. For the sets that didn't work out with the location, they converted a lot of buildings. The hotel that needed to be opposite a farm to show the pigs squealing in the morning, that was once a hotel, but it was shut down. And by the time they went, it was falling apart so much that they had to reinforce the floor so that they wouldn't fall through. The hotel that was across from the pool hall was actually a warehouse that they converted. The court set was also built in a warehouse, and it was a warehouse with a tin roof. So in the summer, it got up to 120 degrees in there sometimes. And when it rained, which it was raining a lot, they had to stop because it ruined the audio because they said it was like being inside a tin drum. Unfortunately, all of these weather issues contributed to some tension on set. And the court scenes took 4 weeks to shoot because of all the different angles that they had to shoot at to show everyone's point of view, you know, like the jury point of view, the state attorney point of view, the district attorney point of view, Vinny's point of view, Lisa's point of view, the judge's point of view, Bill and Stan's point of view. And one day, Pesci was just overtired, and Lynn laughed when Pesci was already edgy, and reportedly, according to McGill, Pesci had a bit of a hissy fit and left set. But, you know, he did feel bad after the fact, and that was the only time something like that happened. The cast all seemed to get along for the most part. Pesci took Tomei under his wing and helped her with her comedic performance. The entire cast actually was staying in a golf resort, and they would have every meal together. They spent every weekend together. They hung out after shooting. The producer, Paul Schiff, said it was like summer camp. And I think that's always a good thing. I mean, on While You Were Sleeping, they said it was like summer camp too. They would like go dancing afterwards. They'd work out in the hotel gym. And Bill Pullman said like Sandra Bullock was like a camp counselor. Anyway, back to the movie we're actually covering. The only time that someone left the filming was when Pesci went to go get the Oscar for Goodfellas. And then the next day he came down to set with it and everyone like passed around, look at it. And then they did a little joke in the scene where Vinny is sleeping in prison with a smile on his face because he can finally sleep. And in the first take that they sent to the studio, they had Pesci clutching the Oscar in his arms while he was sleeping. Ralph and Mitch would also hang out at the Atlanta Mall every Sunday. And most notably, to Ralph Macchio, it was the first time he went to a California pizza kitchen. And Whitfield continued his pioneering impact and introduced playing Tetris on the Game Boy. The cast's chemistry and script combine are amazing and make this movie a go-to watch, but the little details used in the camera shots make the movie better with each watch because you notice all the little details throughout. The first instance of this is when they back up from the convenience store, which was a real convenience store. They have a crane shot so that you can see all the houses that the witnesses live in. And when they're interviewed at the police station, Stan is interviewed in the storeroom and Bill is interviewed in the sheriff room because they wanted to give that effect that it's a small station with just a sheriff room, outer room, and storeroom. And when Vinny makes his star entrance, when he steps out of the car in his little black leather cowboy boots, the court is framed behind him. A little cute detail. And when Vinny and Lisa are staying at the Nightmare Motels with the train, the specifically the one with the train that goes by with the blowing whistle in the morning, they have everything like shaking and the glasses fall off the table and break. And I think now maybe people will be like, that's over the top. But this was actually because when you use film, there's a limit on the sound level that the soundtrack can withhold, which no longer exists in digital. So they used to have to add visual elements to show just how crazy loud something was. And in the courtroom, they use shots to make Pesci look small in comparison to the judge so that when he goes to the stand, it makes it look like a kid and a teacher. And if you pay attention, the crowd in the courtroom gets bigger as the trial goes on. And as the trial gets better for Vinny, the rain stops and the sun starts to shine in the courtroom. Let's talk about what defied my laws of physics in the most excellent portion of the pod. Ralph Macchio defied and continues to defy the laws of aging. Ralph Macchio was 30 years old, 3-0, when he filmed this. That is insane. He looks like a child. And Mitch Whitfield and Marissa Tomei were both 28 when they filmed this. So Ralph Macchio was older than Lisa. Mitch Whitfield, who played Stan, also played Barry in Friends 3 years after this was filmed, and I feel like he aged so quickly. Because in My Cousin Vinny, to me, maybe it's because he's next to Babyface Macchio, but he looks like a college kid. Like, that makes sense, like an 80s college kid, not a current college kid's. But then, like, in Friends, he is a fully grown man who has a dental practice. I truly believe that. Pretty much every character nails it with their character choices. Bruce McGill, who plays the sheriff, makes really amazing natural acting choices that establish his character with the little time he has on screen. It's just little details that seem like they would actually happen in real life. Like, he's not acting. He is a sheriff. I believe that. Like, when Ralph Macchio says something like, are we really in trouble? And he just goes, oh yeah, yeah, you can say that. And then he threatens Bill with death row whilst in the typical, you know, sassy sheriff pose of dropping the left hip and having the right hand on hip. And Ralph Macchio's, whoa, wait a minute. I feel like Ralph didn't have as much time to shine in this because his character is just defending Vinny to Stan most of the time and talking about magic. But this line shows everything that Ralph is capable of. He was my favorite character in The Outsiders, and I am still angry, infuriated, and offended that my two favorite characters were the only ones that died in the entire film. This is about greasers and preppies. They're battling. Maybe it's West Side Story. I don't know. But the only ones who died? Are you joking? Not even a bystander. Like, okay. We're calling that a coincidence. Oh, it's not a personal slight. The book and movie were both made before I was born. Okay, sure, you keep telling yourself that, but I know the truth. Joe Pesci is amazing in every scene. He doesn't make a single wrong acting choice. Pretty much, that's just his entire career that applies, but we're talking about this movie. Like, obviously, yelling, and let me see, what else could we pile on? Is there anything else that we could possibly pile on to the outcome of this case? Is it possible? And you're in Alabama. They think you killed a good old boy. There's no way. This is not going to trial. That should have won him the Oscar. And that should also be the titles of the two-step process of going from stressed to apathetic. But my favorite minuscule details are that, one, Vinny tips a prison guard, and he also gets distracted by his own pen during the trial, and he carries around a deck of cards, and he wears two pinky rings, which reminds me of the movie Moonstruck. It looks stupid. It's a pinky ring. It's a man's ring. It's temporary. Everything is temporary. That don't excuse nothing. And also the episode of Laverne and Shirley, where Laverne dates a guy who taps his pinky ring. I also thought it was funny that Vinny watches where Trotter puts his suitcase and when he writes down what the judge says, and then Vinny mimics him. Okay, let's talk about Lisa. Lisa's outfits were the precursor to Fran Fine's season one. And I love the glitter tights. I think they're amazing. And they set the tone, okay? Glitter tights are when you want to say, we're having fun, we're being playful. These are the itchiest things that I'm ever going to wear, other than wool. But once a year, it is on like Donkey fucking Kong. And Marissa Tomei is this movie. Joe Pesci is amazing. No one else could do this role and keep it as entertaining and fun and tough and still kind, and you love him, but every scene, you want Marissa Tomei in it. You crave it. She brings so much heart, protection, and humor on the screen. She radiates what I aspire to be. She made the character into a person with all the little details that she had. Like when she won't talk to Vinny on the stand because she says, no, I hate him. And how she says to Vinny, because he's dead. And when she's nervous, she paces back and forth like a regular person. I personally pace back and forth in a circle and it drives my mom crazy. And she also does a little adorable high five to Vinny when he disproves his first witness. And then when he goes to jail, he blows her a kiss. That is love. Those little details really cement just how proud they are of each other when they're succeeding, and also showing their knowledge and skill set to everyone else. Joe Pesci and Marissa Tomei's chemistry is so realistic and electric at the same time. Like, they seem like a real couple. Like, it doesn't make sense when you first see them because you're like, oh, that dude's really old and that, she's really young. But once you see him on screen, you're like, yes, this is a real couple that fight, you know? They're like my grandparents fighting over a piece of string on the floor. Josh, would you just pick up the piece of string on the floor? You know what? You're so stupid. You know what? Don't even look at me. But if, you know, if they actually really liked each other a lot. And the scene that best encapsulates their dynamic in how good their reactions are to each other is the scene where Vinny asks Lisa what pants to go hunting in. Tomei brings it with the energy and performance, and Pesci responds with facial interactions. It's active listening, people. When Lisa goes on her rant about the deer going to a brook to have some clear, cool water, and then she shouts, "Bam! A fucking bullet hits you in the head!" Vinny's eyes shoot open in shock and terror. And Lisa continues and she goes, "Your brains are scattered all over the fucking ground!" And Vinny looks down on the ground. Yes! Call Juilliard now! Call the Oscars! Tell him get another one prepped! And continuing with the theme of details, there are a ton of cute little set details. When Bill's on the phone with his mom, there's a little poster of the anatomy of a pistol, terrifying to see in a police department, on the wall behind them, and the way that they position the poster, the pistol is pointed at Bill's head. Another cute set detail, which doesn't have really any nuance or joke in it, is the diner that they go to for breakfast, which has a great joke that all the menu says for options is breakfast, lunch, dinner without any further explanation. The great detail that has no joke in it is that the diner has a chocolate dispenser. That's amazing. That's like the Skittles dispenser at White's Family Fun Center. They also use the traveling alarm clock to show each time, like, what the time is when Vinny's going to sleep and what time it is when he wakes up. So you know, without them explicitly saying it, that he's getting, like, an hour or a half of sleep every day. And when Vinny and Trotter meet each other in his office, they set up that Trotter's a hunter because his office is full of, like, stuffed birds and boar's heads and... This is probably also to symbolize that, you know, he wins a lot of game. Because that's what hunting is, you know, I think. I don't know what hunting is. I don't get it, personally. And maybe another way to symbolize it is, like, he has all of these trophies. And Bill and Stan's heads are next. Maybe that's a little too dark. But on to a lighter note. I love a star dramatic entrance. It is right up there with montages. And this star entrance contains a montage of local reactions. It's the best of both worlds. And they also use a star entrance to begin the mud in the tire bit. As they enter, with the music blasting, you can hear throughout the music, like, little weird pops, and that's some mud bumping around in the tires. And then later on in the film, after they get stuck in the mud at the cabin, when they're driving back into town, you can hear the mud of the tires doing a little pop weird thing. And in this entrance with the mud and the tires, that is phenomenal because it's setting up that they're unfamiliar with the area and this area's famous mud, and both Vinny and Mona Lisa know about cars. What I love in the follow-up to the star entrance is Vinny isn't secure about Lisa knowing everything about cars. When the guy comes up to them and says they have mud in their tires, Vinny says to Lisa, "You ever heard of that?" And she says, "No." And Vinny replies to the guy, "She knows everything about cars. She's never heard of it." And he gets so excited in court when she does her earth-shattering speech on positive traction and limited slip differentials and independent rear suspension. This car had independent rear suspension. And even when Vinny gets frustrated at her, it's because he's stressed about the court case and he's lashing out wrongfully at Lisa. I'm guessing the reason that he lashes out when she tries to help with the law rather than when she's helping with car information is because he isn't insecure about his knowledge of cars, but he is insecure about his ability to win this case. And even when he does lash out, he knows he's in the wrong, and he tries to make it up to Lisa. The first time he lashes out at Lisa is about the disclosure, and he doesn't want her reading his Alabama court procedure book. But later on, when Trotter calls Vinny and says that he's got a clue that'll take the case, Vinny reiterates what Lisa told him about disclosure to Trotter, and then he also asks Lisa where she read about disclosure in the book, and this helps him the next day because he uses this information to object to Trotter bringing in an expert without giving proper notice to Vinny to allow him to research the issue that the expert is covering, or for Vinny to procure an expert in the same field to argue with the other expert's opinion. This then comes back when Vinny has Lisa, a general automotive expert, argue with Trotter as tire mark expert, which ends up winning the case because Lisa actually wins the entire case. She's the mastermind. She tells Vinny about disclosure, which gives Vinny access to Trotter's files and witnesses. She takes the photos that prove Bill and Stan's innocence, and her expert testimony also proves Bill and Stan's innocence. And then she faxes Judge Malloy to have him confirm that Vinny has Jerry Callow's court experience so that Vinny isn't arrested. The other time that Vinny lashes out at Lisa is when he's on the lunch break trying to find something he's missing, and Lisa is asking how to help. He gets frustrated and he's like, oh, what's that look supposed to mean? That look's supposed to mean that I'm a piece of shit because I can't find a way for you to help? And then he just goes, okay, you're helping. Let's look at your photos. Your photos are gonna help. And Vinny's also portrayed as generally nice. You know, he gets a little impatient with people, but overall, he's respectful to everyone, even to the witnesses, other than the reading glasses guy who was honestly a jerk, but he's all very nice to them. He calls the old lady dear, it's really sweet. My other favorite entrance is when Lisa and Vinny enter the pool hall and the music in the background comes to a record-scratching stop. In the scene when he's threatening TJ, Pesci really showcases his ability to say tough shit and threaten someone in a way that sounds humorous, but also, like, pent up. You can see it in his eyes. There's so much pent-up rage just, like, waiting to be released. And he's like, just, you know, I dare you. I dare you to release it. No one has ever said, what if I was just to kick the ever-loving shit out of you? With such anger and delight in their voice before or after this. And I'm including me. Another great bit in that scene is Vinny asking the guy in the neck brace about how he got his injury and the location that he was injured at, because Vinny's a personal injury lawyer, which, no, I did not get the first time I watched this. This is just a great bit overall, the running $200 gag. And as I said before, the movie is so trim, and almost every scene is used for the buildup of either the relationship theme or the case theme, which then intersect and are solved at the same time. What? Are you joking? That is so amazing. It is efficient and emotionally effective. Get out of here. Even when Bill and Stan are just arguing about whether or not to have the state attorney, Stan says to Bill, what if Vinny asks all the possible questions and the witness has all the answers? He ends up proving the prosecution's case. And that is exactly what Stan's state attorney ends up doing with the witness with the reading glasses. And when we have a fun montage of Vinny interviewing the witnesses in their homes with Lisa's cameras, he's actually asking the question that he later asked them in the trial to disprove their eyewitness testimony. And the film is both fun and educational, and teaches me about trial procedure and also what grits are. I'm from Massachusetts. I've never had grits in my life. I didn't know they were hominy from corn. And I completely relate to Vinny being freaked the fuck out by nature. I am a vegetarian. One time there was a mouse in my dorm and I turned into the freaking Son of Sam. It was gonna be me or Fievel, and I chose me. And my instincts kicked in, and I was terrified of this mouse, and even more terrified of how fast I was willing to go into the trenches with a mouse. And all I had with a can of Lysol, a brick, a plastic ramen bowl, and a plant mister, and I barricaded his exit from the side of my desk with that ramen bowl, and he started climbing up the wall. And my first instinct was to knock him out with Lysol fumes, but then I Googled it, and it wouldn't knock him out, it would just hurt his lungs. So I spray him with a plant mister, and the spray of water scares him into scurrying down. Should I use a brick? No, too gruesome. The crunching and the blood and then the slam and no, okay, there's got to be another way. Okay, so that's a last resort though. But just in case, I don't want to kill him. I just want him gone. We'll keep the brick just in case. Last resort, he attacks me. I'll kill him in self-defense with the brick. I call my mom on the verge of tears, ready to be leaped at and attacked and infected with a hantavirus and probably die. I don't really know what happens when you get the hantavirus. While I'm distracted, talking to my mom, the mouse jumps the height of more than my entire desk, like Vinny leaping at TJ, and I shriek so loud my mom thought the mouse got me, and I see that son of a bitch in the hall who didn't even knock on my ajar door to see if I was dead, and then I start for real crying, and my mom tells me to open the door, so I do, and the mouse runs out, and I get a sandwich and a roll of Lifesavers and a bunch of screening and duct tape to block all my vents and a draft blocker to put under my door so the mouse can't get back in. Now I know what you're thinking. Couldn't he get past the barricades and scurry in when you're opening or closing your door? And obviously he wants to get back in for one, revenge, for two, good times, for three, a feast. And I realize that I assumed this mouse's gender because of internalized misogyny. But on to the quicker problem solution. Naturally, to know if the mouse got back in, before I went to bed every night for the next, we'll just say month, but it was longer than that. But month. It was a month. Every night, I would basically act like a helicopter in an air raid and look for any droppings on the floor with a flashlight, the obvious, totally sane solution. And then I would sweep my floor so that I'd know if I did see any droppings, they were new and I was back on the hunt. From my knowledge, the mouse never returned in physical form. But in emotional distress, the mouse has been a visitor. Let's talk about the most heinous parts of the movie and the most bogus portion of the pod. Let's start with what aged terribly. The stutterer joke. This joke, I hope, would not happen today because I think more people are aware that it's really insensitive to make fun of someone's affliction. Even if you cast an actor who's dealt with the affliction in real life and can portray it in a realistic way, it should never be portrayed in a joke. And I really hate the emotional and career hell that it put Austin Pendleton through. He seems like such a nice man. And even if he wasn't such a nice man, he shouldn't have had to go through that. On to the less serious notes. Stan kind of annoys me a bit, but, you know, in all fairness, if I was on death row, I'd probably most likely definitely be irritable and nervous all the time. But apparently not nervous enough to ever try to contact his parents. In the beginning, Stan says his parents are climbing the mountains in Chile or whatever, but you'd think after Stan learns that this case's outcome could be death row, like, you're dead, honey, he'd maybe try to contact his parents, but he never does. Like, what, were they just supposed to return from Chile, try to contact their son, and then get informed that, oh, they can't reach him because he was tried and killed for accessory to murder in Alabama? Like, they explain why Bill's mother isn't there because the creators thought that people would wonder why an Italian mother wouldn't be there for her son's trial. So they have Bill say when they're playing basketball, like, my mother, the way her health is right now. So why couldn't they have Stan say something like, well, my mom still can't be reached, so that we'd at least know he tried to contact his parents about his possible eternal erasure from this plane of existence. Another weird detail is, why does a small lumber mill run town have so many hotels? Is this for like lumber conferences or something? How often are lumber conferences? And I understand the judge being curt with Vinny after Vinny doesn't follow the court procedure, because the judge does say to Vinny in their first meeting that he's not patient when it comes to breaking court procedure. So obviously we know it's going to be an issue. But what I thought was rude is, at this first meeting, he goes to hand the gigantic Alabama court procedure book to Vinny. And Vinny is like obviously reaching out to grab the book that it looks like the judge is handing to him. Like he's just passing the book hand to hand. No, the judge drops it on the desk. Like, what? You don't even know the guy. What the hell is your problem? My other issue is, as previously discussed, to look young in this film, Pesci used a device that pulls back your face at the eyebrow area. And in long shots on the side of Pesci's face, you can like see the skin actively being pulled back, and it looks so odd. And it just takes me out of the film for a bit, because I'm just like looking like, what the hell is going on? What is that? What's happening? And before I knew that he was using this, I was like, is Joe Pesci's face just like that? Another cosmetic detail that drives me nuts is Ralph Macchio's peach fuzz mustache that comes in like halfway through the movie. I think to be like, look at what prison's doing to them. Stan has a 5 o'clock shadow and Bill has a peach fuzz mustache because they can't shave, or maybe they can. I don't know how prison works, but I'm assuming they can shave at some point. Like, I'm assuming not everyone in prison has a beard. I don't know. And the last detail is just for me, but Vinny's car is so long. It is insane when they frame it to show the car stuck in the mud. Merging with that thing or parallel parking, which I haven't done since I was 16, would be hell. My anxiety, the sweats, would be insane. On to a more tranquil note, let's move into our peaceful portal and discuss what about this film is comforting to me. I'd say every 3 months or so, I go through a 1 to 2 week period where I become deeply entrenched in my love and obsession with Joe Pesci and Peter Falk and season one Fran Fine and Natasha Lyonne and Fran Lebowitz, especially Fran Lebowitz. And I drink a lot of black coffee and wear overcoats, sometimes indoors, and listen to instrumental music and Lou Reed. And I'm like, yeah, people fucking suck. They're the worst. In my mind during this time, I'm like, you know what? You know, in my heart, I'm a super tough, I don't give a fuck, rough and tough-em 1970s New Yorker. And then, eventually I have to come to terms with that delusional part of my brain. And remember that I'm not like that. I'm not a rough and tough-em 1970s New Yorker at all. I'm from the suburbs of Massachusetts, and I'm not Hungarian or Russian or Italian or Jewish, and I don't smoke. But in that little delusional part of my mind, I convince myself every once in a while that I'm an extremely cool, angry person that should run the world, when in reality, yeah, I'm an extremely nerdy, angry person that if I did run the world, there would be no human race, because honestly, I don't care enough. And it's nice to have delusions of grandeur sometimes. And I say grandeur because everyone that I just listed is so much better than me, and so much better than, I would say, a lot of people. but not you. If you're listening, you're great. And thanks for listening. And thank you for joining me in escaping my existence into the peaceful portal of films from before the year 2000. I hope you'll join me in our next episode on The Cheap Detective. This podcast is released every other Tuesday on all listening platforms. If you like the episode, please rate and review our podcast on your listening platform of choice. Apple Podcasts is preferred, but any support is appreciated. If you want, you can also tell a friend or a loved one or even a stranger that you think would like the show to give it a listen. Any and all support is appreciated. If you want to keep updated on the pod or tell us what about the film is comforting to you, you can catch us on Instagram at the letter Y2000pod and on Letterboxd at Y2Kpod. Thanks for listening to Y2K. We love you something fierce. And thank you to Yusu Kim for a totally rad theme song, and to Bonnie Cohen for our gnarly-ass podcast art.